Welcome to the Back of the Bullpen podcast. This is episode one. Matt's already laughing. That is Matt Corey in Portland.
Here I am.
And I am Jason Wojciechowski in Los Angeles. Because this is episode one, I think we should take 30 seconds and just say what we're doing here. Hopefully you noticed that we posted this on a Sunday. That is the whole goal of this. We want to be a weekly baseball podcast, relatively short, half an hour at the most. Posted on Sundays because most podcasts don't post on Sundays, but you guys still have to go places on Sundays and you have to listen to things and you have to go on runs and you might still want fresh podcast content. So that is what we are trying to provide. We want to be funny. We want to have occasional nods to odd and ridiculous things, and we want to talk about curious and interesting things. So it's not going to be heavily analytical, but so give us a shot. Listen to us talk about today, Joe Girardi, Roger Clemens, and
baseball seats.
Yes, and the best seat we've ever had at a baseball game. Yeah, with that, why don't you take us to our first segment, Matt?
So Joe Girardi has sort of an odd reputation in baseball. I mean, first it's hard to figure, you know, with the money that the Yankees have and the talent that the Yankees have, it's sort of hard to separate what he is as a manager from all that talent. You know, does he add to it? Does he take away from it? And ultimately, does it even matter? But this year, things have been a little different for the Yankees. They had a bunch of injuries to pitchers, Michael Pineda, most notably in spring training, and of course Mariano Rivera. And then Andy Pettitte came back, and then he got hurt. And so there's been a bunch of injuries to various Yankee players. And Girardi has managed to hold the boat together. As of this recording date, and we're recording this on September 14th, which is a Friday night, the Yankees lost tonight, but so did the Orioles. So the Yankees are still tied for first place. I think that's saying something. Girardi kind of has this reputation as maybe a little hard-headed. He's the guy carrying the binder around, and that's easy to poke fun at. In fact, I've always wanted to start a Twitter account called Joe Girardi's Binder, then I was run up against, well, what would I really say as Joe Girardi's Binder? Bunt more? But that actually brings me to another topic. Girardi is not bunting a lot. The Yankees are second in baseball in fewest sacrifice bunts. So Jason, let me throw this at you. Has Joe Girardi done a particularly good job this year? Has he done sort of the same job he's always done? Is he any part of the reason, an important reason that the Yankees are in first place right now?
I don't know.
Okay.
I think, Baseball Prospectus, where we both write, in part, has had kind of a little bit of a manager fetish this week, I think. I think RJ Anderson wrote a piece, and, Dan Evans may have done a piece. I don't quite remember exactly who all did pieces, but there were a number of manager things. And, you know, there's always this question of how much that we can actually see and measure. What percentage of a manager's job is that? And you see, 10 to 15% is the on-field stuff. And, maybe it's that. On the other hand, I read somewhere, I don't remember where it was, an inside baseball person saying that it's like 30, 40%, that a manager has to be able to put together a reasonable lineup and has to be able to call the right strategies at the right times. So even inside baseball, not everybody is completely downplaying those elements, which Girardi seems to be good at. I mean, that's the funny thing about the binder is people like the binder, the binder, the binder. Well, the binder has numbers in it, and that's what we want managers to look at.
That's what you think. That's what you think. It could be pictures of Bullwinkle.
It could be pictures of Bullwinkle. Hopefully it's pictures of Rocky, but we'll see when he retires and the binder is finally, we can put it a freedom of information request for the binder. Yeah, exactly. And it's actually got lists of Communist Party members that he's been secretly tracking. I mean, I think one of the things about Girardi is, you know, not to, and I really don't do this to pick on you as a Red Sox fan, but and some of this is because the Yankees have been winning, and, you know, winning, as I think you've said many times, winning as a way of creating chemistry. And it's not, you know, you didn't invent that. And I, the first person to say it didn't even invent it. You know, nobody invented that phrase. That phrase has just been around. But there still haven't really been, you know, maybe you remember something, controversies, have there?
No. And that was kind of the impetus for the subject, you know, looking at the Red Sox is, you know, the polar opposite comparison, sadly. You know, they have managed to is foment the right word? Controversy and discontent and sadness and anger and a bunch of other emotions that don't necessarily contribute to winning baseball. And I don't think anyone would claim that the New York media is any more difficult or any easier, excuse me, than the Boston media. You know, the personalities in the Yankee clubhouse are, you know, not more difficult or less difficult to deal with. I think they're comparable situations, and at the same time, you know, the Red Sox have had this horrible implosion, and over the last year have put together this, you know, roughly 400 winning percentage, and the Yankees just keep going. You know, they really haven't had a lot of outstanding performances this year. Derek Jeter has had a very good year.
Cano is kind of an MVP possibility. Not to win, but to be in the conversation.
He's in the conversation, right. To steal from the Effectively Wild folks, he's in the conversation. He's in the back end of the conversation, thanks to Mike Trout, but he's in the conversation. But, you know, looking at pitcher WARP, you know, BP's stat, Sabathia had 2.7, Kuroda is 1.8, and Phil Hughes is 1.7. Those are their three best pitchers. That's not what you typically think of, you know, when you think of a first place team that wears the Yankees hats. So, I don't know. I think Girardi has done a pretty good job of doing what Joe Torre always used to get credit for, which is, you know, insulating the clubhouse from, you know, the crazy maelstrom of New York media and fans. And I guess I would probably be remiss if I didn't specifically mention Derek Jeter, whose constant bloopers, you know, by hitting the ball just over the second baseman's head drive me to distraction. But from all reports, Jeter is a you know, a rock in the clubhouse. And for whatever that's worth, I don't know. I don't know if without him in the clubhouse, maybe there's a, you know, maybe the Yankees pick up pitchforks and charge Girardi's office. I don't know. But he's certainly some part of holding that team together.
Presumably you have to get, not you have to, I'm not going to tell you what to do, but presumably you give a manager credit for recognizing, you know, because Jeter was long established on that team before Girardi ever comes in. So right. Girardi has to come in, although, I mean, Girardi played on the team a little bit and overlapped with Jeter, although not necessarily during Jeter's leadership phase. I don't remember when Girardi retired as a player. Right?
Well, Jeter has always, I think, leaked leadership ever since his days as an infant.
This is we'll have to do an investigation. We'll have to talk to his parents and okay, find out, you know, whether he led them around the house. Girardi inherits a culture and inherits a clubhouse and inherits a front office. You know, it's not like the team was cleaned out and like an Astros situation next year where whoever is going to be the manager of that team is also dealing with a front office that's almost brand new and that has a GM who's been there for only a year and, you know, lots of positions with changeover, and they can kind of grow up together. Girardi had a well-established clubhouse and a well-established front office in particular, because players always change, and has to figure out how to integrate himself into that, not to come in and try to kick ass and take names and, you know, just just to sort of a winning team and have them continue to be a winning team. The fact that he's done that, the fact that there isn't constant you know, what's the biggest controversy in New York right now? Mike Francesa falling asleep. Like, that's, you know, that's the kind of thing that New Yorkers are obsessed with. It's nothing to do with the team. I mean, New Yorkers are also obsessed with the fact that they're tied with the Orioles. Here's the thing. Oh, Girardi's so good. Why are they tied with the Orioles then? The Orioles are terrible. But that's more on the Orioles being weirdly crazy good, obviously, than on the Yankees. I have no idea how good Girardi. I guess what it comes down to is I have no idea how good Girardi is, but I suspect he's probably pretty good.
I think you just have to, because yeah, none of us knows. So I think what you have to do is, unless it's painfully obvious, you know, like if you can, you see the comments that were made in the paper, and then you hear a player make, comments against those comments, and then the player gets traded like that happened in Boston with Kevin Youkilis. That's not hard. You don't have to extrapolate. But I think normally what you do is you look at the team formed, and then you do your best to analyze, you know, those sort of non-off-the-field factors. Not non-off-the-field factors, but just off-the-field factors. And you do what you can with that and, you know, try to paint the whole picture. And I think the best that we can do is like you said, you know, looking at Girardi and the Yankees and the way that they have, the way their year is gone. I think it's pretty safe to say that, you know, that he's done a pretty good job. One other quick point before we move on to our next subject. I'm just looking down their roster right now. And not only do they have a lot of star players, but they have a lot of ex-stars. Eric Chavez and Russell Martin and Pettit, I guess, is on there. And Ichiro is the other guy I was thinking of. I mean, those guys are all big names. They're not necessarily big performers anymore, but they're still big names. And probably, I don't know this for a fact, but probably big egos, guys who think highly of themselves and want to be treated in a certain way. And to Girardi, to Girardi's, you know, credit, I think none of that, adding a bunch of guys who used to be really good in backup roles. Ibanez is another guy, or Ibanez. None of that has fomented dissent in the clubhouse in any way. So unless you have anything else to add on this, I think we should move on to our next subject.
Yeah, I think now is a good time to go to, you know, shockingly, despite this being our first episode, despite, you know, nobody knowing who we are, we managed to pull in advertisers, which I think is pretty remarkable.
That is impressive. And I think it's a credit to you, sir, for, you know, really getting out there and, you know, knocking on doors and talking to people.
That's precisely what I did. You know, I went up and down Madison Avenue and just got the job done, basically. So well done. Our first sponsor this week is The Color Purple, not the book, but the actual color.
Our second sponsor this week is Doilies. They are probably something.
Our third sponsor are the olden times. They were so much better. Baseball players used to be named Old Hoss. The olden times, they should come back.
They should. Something else that should come back is black market brand Tiger Meat. High in antioxidants, protein, low in carbohydrates, and now featuring the high mineral content of 100% real buckshot. Black market brand Tiger Meat, pretty much the perfect meat. Okay, so those are our advertisers. How about we move on to our next subject, Jason?
So Roger Clemens, you've heard of him, Matt?
Yeah, he's a guy who does things with the stuff at the place.
Yeah, okay, well, that was our second topic. So Roger Clemens, in something that is, it's hard to tell just how much it's a stunt, how much it's him legitimately trying to come back and pitch, how much, why he might want to come back and pitch, but which I'll come back to in just one second. But hey, he's pitched a couple of times. I'm not entirely sure how many times for the Sugar Land Skeeters. Sugar Land is in the Houston area, and the Skeeters is are actually it's a strip club team. This is why they have such a pornographic name. He's pitched a couple of times for them. They signed his son so his son could catch him. So that's where you ask, is it a stunt? Apparently there were a lot of scouts. The Astros, there was talk that the Astros might actually want to sign him. On the other hand, there was talk that scouts just wanted to go out and watch Roger Clemens, who's one of the greatest pitchers ever. And they haven't gotten to watch him pitch in a while. The last time he pitched in the major leagues was 2007 with the Yankees at the age of 44. He's 50 now. He didn't pitch as well. You look at his numbers and you say, oh, 4.18 ERA, that's not Roger Clemens. And then you think about it, the 4.18 ERA in New York in 2007, that's pretty good. For a 44-year-old, in 2005, as a 42-year-old in Houston, he had a 1.87 ERA in 211 innings. Not like injury, not one of these half seasons like Roy Oswalt or like Clemens did in 2006 and 2007. I don't remember exactly the circumstances of 2006 and 7, whether he did like a half year like Pettit and all those people or whether he had got hurt or what it was. But he's pitched really well into his 40s, might still be able to go out and be like a short reliever in the major leagues right now at 50. So the question, I guess, is do we want him to do that as like fans of the game? Are we interested in seeing that?
See, this is complicated by my many things, by my Red Sox fandom, by my childhood as a huge Roger Clemens fan, by Clemens eventually joining the Yankees. The history is not particularly kind, but I wrote a piece at Baseball Prospectus a while ago about Andy Pettit coming back from retirement. I concluded the piece by saying that I don't think I specifically mentioned that I'm not a huge Andy Pettit fan, which I'm not. But as a big baseball fan, I think you always want the best players on the field. And if he is still one of the best players, and now I'm talking about Clemens, if he's still one of the best players, then you want him on the field. You can say a lot of things about Roger Clemens, but I think it's indisputable that he is one of the best pitchers of all time. And, one of the things that defines, an inner circle Hall of Famer, to use that term, is that, not only that they defy the typical aging pattern. So not only are they good for longer and much, much better at the peak years, but their peak is, the descent from the peak is much less. It's not as steep a drop off, is what I'm trying to say. It takes a lot longer to reach, a sub major league pitcher status. And it is possible that at the age of 50 that Clemens hasn't reached that yet. If he can pitch, even if it's for the extra crappy Astros, trying to decide whether to swear or not, I would love to see it. I mean, is there any reason to watch the Astros now? I think they were just talking about the low ratings that the Astros got. And I think the Astros ratings equated to about 1,100 households watching, or maybe it's 1,100 televisions. I'm not sure which. In either case, very, very few people in the Houston area were watching. So there's really very little reason for anyone to watch the Astros right now. Nobody's watching the Astros right now. Roger Clemens would be a reason to watch the Astros right now. He would also be a reason to watch the Astros next year. One final point on this before I throw it back to you. I recall Jim Palmer, after he was elected to the Hall of Fame, decided that he wanted to try a comeback with the Orioles. And I remember the big to-do about that. While he was in spring training, he never actually finished spring training. He realized that at the age of whatever it was, he was probably close to Clemens' age at this point, that the game had actually passed him by. Incredible talent though he was, he wasn't going to be able to get major league hitters out at the age of 50. But if Clemens can do that, I sure would like to see it.
I think you mentioned the Hall of Fame, and I think that's, to shift the topic a little bit. As I mentioned in the introduction, one of the rumors, I guess, about why he might want to come back and make an appearance in the major leagues is to delay his appearance on the Hall of Fame ballot, because, of course, he is connected with performance-enhancing drugs. I think
it's a tenuous connection, though. Very tenuous.
Yeah, it is so tenuous that nobody's quite sure if he used them or not. But I it's to the extent that this would work, I am for it, because I think he should be in the Hall of Fame. And I think if whenever he would go on the ballot, which if he retired in 2007, that's, I guess, he'll go on the next ballot, right? Because that's 5 years. I don't know that the writers are ready to elect him, given that he used performance enhancing drugs. And there's a 10 years from now, they're probably ready, in which case maybe the delay doesn't matter. But it feels like a little bit of a tarnishment to have him sitting around waiting 10 years. So if he pitches, and then he goes, maybe he goes in on the fifth ballot instead of the 10th or the third ballot or whatever it is. On the other hand, then it's transparent, potentially, what he's doing. Maybe the writers resent that. I don't really know. I don't really know how to pull together all these different factors. I get what it comes down to, and I think I've said that phrase twice now, that I want Roger Clemens in the Hall of Fame. I don't want it to be a long, tortured process. I don't want this to be like Burt Blyleven, where he potentially might not get in. He squeaks in on the last ballot. And I actually do agree with you that as to the on the field aspect, that if he can pitch, it'd be fun to watch him pitch. I kind of missed Clemens' career, basically, because we didn't really have cable. And so I didn't really watch a lot of baseball when I was younger. And then I was in college for his Yankees years. And so I didn't watch a ton of baseball in college. I would, try to catch the playoffs at the beginning of the year when classes were just sort of ramping up. And then in the middle years, MLB TV wasn't really on my radar. And then, by 2007, no, even 2007, I hadn't gotten it yet. So I kind of didn't really see Clemens very much. I mean, I knew who he was. Yeah. And I knew he was great. And I was a very active sort of internet baseball fan, right? I read the articles and blah, blah, blah. But in terms of and I can picture him pitching in my mind is the thing. He does have a fairly distinctive look and approach on the mound. And I've seen him enough to know what that is. But I haven't watched him throughout a season, I guess. And it would be fun, I think, to get the chance to do that. Now, if he's not a starting pitcher, that's harder, because how do you tune in for a reliever? You have to know he's going to, you don't know if he's going to pitch or not. And I'm not about to watch every Astros game on the off chance that Clemens gets into the sixth inning. So then you're like, well, do I go back and watch Clemens's inning in the archive? So maybe in terms of actually seeing him pitch, maybe I wouldn't actually watch him pitch, so it doesn't matter.
Well, there's always highlights.
What's that?
There's always highlights. You can always go back and watch it. Even if it's not in real time, you can go back and watch the inning, as it unfolded and watch the, watch the master at work, or watch the master get shelled, as the case may be.
Well, that's the risk, right? Is that he does make it out of spring training, unlike Jim Palmer, that he goes into the season and that he pitches 10 or 15 horrendous innings. And then, it doesn't change anything about his career. It doesn't make it it does make it less valuable. It might subtract 0.2 war from his career or something like that. Yeah. But it doesn't substantially change anything. But it certainly changes our memories, I think. I mean, if you're a basketball fan, Michael Jordan playing for Washington changes our memory of his of how his career went. And I think people say, oh, it tarnished his legacy. And I don't like that. And I don't agree with that. And I don't think it did. Jordan was still the best player any of us have ever seen. But it's kind of icky and weird that he did this at the end of his career. And if Clemens were to be unsuccessful, it would once again feel icky and weird. And you'd be like, I kind of wish you hadn't done that. And so there's a downside risk in terms of, you know, what am I rooting for here? Do I want to root for this? I mean, it doesn't affect anything. Clemens isn't listening to this. Well, maybe he's listening. Are you listening, Roger? Email us. I don't know that it actually matters whether we root for him to come back or not. But, you know, it makes me worry that I'm going to look at his stat line in 10 years and see 2013 on there and look over and there's like a 5.7 ERA and 4 strikeouts in 12 innings or something like that. And you're just like, oh, Roger.
I think that's an interesting point because I think this is something maybe we should shelve for a later podcast because I think this could lead to an interesting discussion because I no offense sir but I disagree with you about the changing of the way we perceive the players I don't think people necessarily think of Jordan any less than they did. Willie Mays is a good example. You hear people talk about how he what a shell of himself he was with the Mets, in the early 60s, when he was, I don't know how old he was, actually. I think he was in his 40, roughly around 40.
I think he was 40, 41, 42, somewhere around there.
Yeah. For some reason, 42 comes to mind, but I don't have any specific reason to say that. I think you still think of Mays as one of the greatest center fielders ever in the history of baseball. I tend to think that, I don't know if you can call it ancillary because he was still playing, but bits like that sort of fall to the wayside. When you're thinking of great players. I mean, if you think of Sandy Koufax, who had this sort of shortish peak, 3 or 4, or actually might have been 5 years even, of really great pitching. Then he hurt his arm in his early 30s, I think it was, and then didn't pitch anymore. If he had come back and been sort of a Frank Tanana. Before Frank Tanana, sort of junk baller who put up a 90 ERA plus for the last 5 years of his career, would we think any less of him? I mean, I wouldn't. I don't. You would look. Well, he had the serious arm injury, and he was this great pitcher, and that then he was a different pitcher. That's what happened with Tanana. He was a fireballer, and then. He had a serious arm injury, and he couldn't throw that fast anymore, and he had to reinvent himself in a certain way. There's, I think it's pretty impressive. That's why I alluded to Clemens's age, when I was talking about if he could do it still. I mean, I think that's kind of the amazing thing. We know Roger Clemens at the age of 25. Is one of the best pitchers ever. We know Roger Clemens at the age of 35 is one of the best pitchers ever. Is Roger Clemens with the handicap, to use that word, of being 50 years old, still a great pitcher? I don't know. I'd like to watch. I'd like to find out. So anyway.
I think I will decline to answer your question for the reasons you stated that we could save it for another podcast. And also that I think we have gone well over time on this segment. I will take us into our second segment break and ask you, what did you do this week, Matt?
What did I do this week? Well, let me look it up because I wrote it down. I didn't do that much, but one thing that I did do is this was the first week of football and therefore the first week of fantasy football. I have pared myself down from I think at one point 5 teams. I'm down to 2 now, and I'm pretty focused on those 2. This year I tried and have failed miserably at fantasy baseball, but fantasy football I think is a little easier in the sense that it's a once a week sort of thing. But anyway, so that has allowed me to kick everyone's butt in the first week. So I have 2 teams that beat up on the on my respective opponents this week, and I am now not observing Maddie's 12th corollary, which states that nobody gives a shit about your stupid fantasy football team. So I guess I would say then I really didn't do much this week. Jason, what did you do this week?
I did nothing this week. I did really very little. I think I wrote a baseball prospectus article, and for the most part, other than that, thank you. That's right. It's that one. Yeah, I kind of like that one too. and aside from that, I work too much. However, tomorrow, and this is kind of a weird philosophical time issue, because by the time you're listening to this, all three of you out there, it'll be Sunday, and thus what I'm talking about will have occurred yesterday, but I'm going to talk about it in the future tense. Tomorrow I'm going to Baseball Prospectus' Dodger Stadium event. I've been to one Baseball Prospectus stadium event before down in Anaheim, and we had some cool guests. So it was Matt Klentak and other guy. I don't remember your name. Also from the Angels front office. They were both Angels sort of front office staff members. Relatively young guys, both of them. It was interesting.
Regans?
No, it was much younger than our dear departed Mr. Regans. Is that how you say his name? Either way. So tomorrow, the Dodger Stadium event has Logan White, who is, I think, on the player development side of the Dodgers front office. And he's been there a while, I think. A long-established baseball man and a long-established Dodgers guy. And Vin Scully. Vin Scully is going to talk to us. We are going to meet in person Vin Scully, and I am going to find a way to get my picture taken with Vin Scully just so I can, lord it over my entire Facebook feed, basically. And I don't care if he's taking no pictures. I will, sneak up behind him and have Sam Miller take my picture with the back of Vin Scully's head.
That's good. And can give him money years, too.
What's that? Oh, yeah. I'll give him. So it'll be weird because it'll be on his forehead, but it'll look, it'll be
whatever works.
And there will be a bunch of BP authors there, of course, myself included, Sam. I think Jason Martinez, who's the MLB depth charts guy. I think he might be there. I'm not sure. There's a group of people. Jonah Carey, former BP. So it'll be an interesting time, but it's going to go Vin and then Logan White and then us. So I'm sure our Q&A is going to go awesome. We get to follow Vin Scully. So that's what I did / am doing this week. I think we can move to the final segment, and I will, they're not gonna do any introduction. I'm just gonna ask you, what is the best seat you've ever had at the baseball game?
In the year 2000. Which makes me sound like
Conan O'Brien.
No, I actually saw Conan O'Brien do that live when I lived in New York. I went and saw him. Ben Stiller was on the show promoting something about Mary, and they did that that sketch in the year 2000, which was at the time before the year 2000. So I mean, it made it even funnier that they continued to do the sketch after the year 2000. But anyway. In the year 2000, I was living in Boston, and I walked up to a game and by myself and purchased a single ticket, which you could do at the time, and come to think of it, can probably do now, about 10 or 12 rows behind the Red Sox dugout on the left field line. I think that's the Red Sox dugout, down the left field line in any case. Or on the left or on the third base side is what I'm trying to say. About 12 rows up, and it was the Red Sox against the Indians, and Pedro Martinez was pitching for the Red Sox, and Bartolo Colon was pitching for the Indians, and the Red Sox won, I think it was 2-0. Derek Lowe got the save, and Martinez threw, I think it was a one hitter. He struck out 12 guys. And I was right there, man. It was impressive. I think if it might have been the best seat I've ever had for any game in terms of closeness, but it was also the best game I've ever seen. So it was a nice confluence of events for me there. How about you? What's the unless you have comments on that, what's the best seat you've ever had?
You know what's really going to be very strange? And listeners, we did not actually talk about this beforehand.
Were you sitting on the other side of the stadium?
Not for that game, but okay. In 2000, the best seat I've ever had at a baseball game was in 2000 at a Red Sox game, but on the other side, on the first base side, probably about 10 or 12 rows up. I think actually closer to like, kind of in between the dugout and home plate, you know, so maybe, right. Maybe a quarter of the way up the first baseline, something like that. I don't remember much about the game. I went with, the father of the young lady that I was, having relations with at the time. We didn't discuss that, but he was interesting. He was an interesting guy. He had an auto body shop, and sometimes his customers would pay him in trade, and that's how he got these tickets. So he had these great, you know, these great seats, and he was like, and he didn't really talk much.
This was in Boston?
What's that?
This was in Boston?
Yeah, this was in Boston. They lived in Randolph, Mass. It was over the summer between the school year, between the first and second year, my first and second year in college. And he was like, do you want to come with me? And, those were pretty much the last words I heard him speak. He offered me peanuts at one point, but like we had sort of this weird, like, conversation throughout the game where he'd kind of point and grunt. And like, he was a smart guy. This is not like, he wasn't like a dummy. He was just very nonverbal in this weird way. And it was like it was neat being in the stadium, and it was, you know, it was the Red Sox. I don't remember how they did that year. I feel like John Valentin was still on that team, and that was kind of an interesting team. And unfortunately, Pedro did not pitch that game. That would have been fantastic. But so that's kind of funny that we sat essentially perpendicular. Well, not perpendicular, but in equivalent places in the stadium that same summer. Or did you say it was the summer? Maybe yours wasn't in the summer.
No, it was in – I think it was in June.
Yeah, that's about
the Red Sox won 86 games that year and finished second to the Yankees. And John Valentin – I don't see him on here.
Oh, was he – oh, man, that's –
might
that's
have been embarrassing. Troy O'Leary, Jose Offerman – Brian Daubach, the great Trot Nixon. Anyway, yes.
But yeah, that's funny. No, it was definitely, yeah, and I would have gone in June or July sometime. That's pretty amazing.
Well done. Well, sir, does that do it for us this week?
Yeah, I think given that we went a little over on the other topic, doing a short last segment is good. And so yeah, this has been a pretty good, I think, first episode of the Back of the Bullpen podcast. So, last words, if you have any, Mr. Matt Corey.
No, looking forward to a lot more.
I also have no last words, and. So, goodbye and see you next week.